The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Wednesday, August 9th, 2023. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Mo Tasek, investigations editor at the American Prospect, on our sick system of healthcare. Also on the program today, Nicole Sorrell, audio description narrator, member of the SAG-AFTRA negotiating committee, chair of the LA Performers with Disabilities Committee, on day 26 of the SAG-AFTRA strike. Also on the program, Ohio voters reject Republican issue one in a massive landslide.
Woohoo!
Meanwhile, day 100 of the WGA strike. LA hotel workers in its sixth week of rolling strikes. A major push to amend the Arizona Constitution to protect abortion was launched yesterday. Meanwhile, Supreme Court revives Biden's ghost gun ban. Judge to let a hear protective order arguments on Friday in Trump's election subversion case. Meanwhile, Georgia DA reportedly seeking a grand jury vote on new indictments next week. After changing campaign leadership for his deteriorating presidential run, Ron DeSantis suspends another state prosecutor. Carrie Lake to enter the Arizona Senate race, joining Sinema and Gallego, and the Biden administration issues new restrictions on investment in China. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. It is, in the famous words of my co-host, Emma Vigeland,
it is hump day.
That's right. But it's not just any typical hump day. Longtime listeners may remember that 18 years ago today, Janine Garofalo announced on the Majority Report on Air America that I was a father of a baby.
Whoa.
Yes. And that baby's name was Myla. And if you have ever listened to the free version of the show, you've heard Myla's voice for probably 10 years now, I think. I think she was like maybe more. Maybe from the
beginning. Whole time I've been here.
It could have been from the beginning. She was like 4, I think. Or 6. Anyways, happy birthday to Myla Cedar. She is 18.
An adult now.
She is an adult. It took about 30 seconds for her to be awake this morning when she announced that she's going to get a tattoo, and there's nothing that I can do about it, being her father, and also going to get her own PayPal account now so that she can do her Depop. There was a whole laundry list of stuff that she was going to do that I have no control over.
It's like the fall of the Soviet Union.
She's like, and I think you have some money in my savings account.
Well, she's got to get this all squared away before then she goes to college.
She's going to college days away. And so it's all coming to the fore, ladies and gentlemen. But with all that said, let's continue. I got another 8 years of having a kid in the house. So
yeah.
And it's not like
what's it like?
Not like I'm an empty nester.
Yeah, I mean, you've raised a girl. You're raising a boy now. What's the experience been differently like with the second kid? You feel a little less anxious all the time, or is that just constant?
I mean, I don't know. You can't make broad generalizations, but I can tell you, like, as far as I can tell, like, boys seem easier, or my boy seems easier, which is not to say that Milo is difficult, but.
Yes.
We should try to find those archives, get into those archives, because it is interesting hearing pre-Sam when he hasn't really been a father yet.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different kind of energy, I think.
Oh, my God. Totally. Yeah, it's one where I get sleep.
Like, yeah.
Although, Milo was born within a year of my doing
maybe it hasn't
radio.
It hadn't had its effect until like maybe a few years into it. You still seemed a little bit. Like, you didn't have the responsibility of fatherhood on you.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Now, those days are gone. A lot was beaten out of me over the course of those 18 years. I can tell you that right now. All right. Let's get into this. This is big news. I mean, we've been talking about this Ohio election, or I should say referendum, for a couple of months now, increasingly more as it came closer. It was an amendment to the Constitution to essentially change the mechanism in which Ohio voters had to amend their Constitution. In other words, it has been the case that you need a 50% plus one of the Ohio electorate to amend the Ohio Constitution. There is a referendum to amend the Constitution in Ohio to protect abortion set for November. As a way to preempt this, the Republicans in the Ohio legislature offered this referendum that did not obviously come from citizens, it came from the legislature, which would have raised the threshold to 60%
yes,
or 60% plus, essentially. You got to clear 60%.
And that 50% threshold has been in place since 1912.
Yes.
So it's obviously suspicious timing, and voters had never had a problem with it up until the Republicans tried to ram this through.
Well, voters didn't have a problem with it,
it
turns out. And we interviewed, who was it from Bolts?
Cameron Joseph.
Yeah. Cameron Joseph last week. And I made it clear that what had happened prior to this is that the Republicans were trying to get rid of the idea of doing August elections because nobody shows up and they're expensive and it doesn't make any sense. Why would you have an August election? Why wouldn't you just punt it to November when you're having other elections? However, the Republicans in the legislature thought that it would behoove them to have one in August because people don't show up for elections in August. Except for, you know, if you are a fanatical, usually religious zealot who wants to control other people's sexuality. And in this case, to force women and folks who can get pregnant to carry those pregnancies to birth. And however, it didn't work out that way. I give you Ohio Secretary of State Frank LaRose. Trying to put on a happy face.
Coping.
On Fox and Friends this morning.
So your initiative would make it harder to change the state constitution. Right now, simple majority, 50% plus, but you wanted it 60%. That failed. What's Ohio telling you?
Well, I tell you what, 1.3 million Ohioans stood with us in another free and fair election. We release the results on election night. That's this thing we do in Ohio. Other states should check out. Proud to say that as Ohio's chief elections officer. But
they released the results on election night because it was so overwhelming. Because within minutes of polls closing, I saw Wasserman tweet out that I've seen enough, and I was like, oh my god, that quickly.
You know what? A lot of Secretary of States have is a real grasp on math.
Mm.
And 1.3 million Ohioans is a lot of Ohioans.
Mm.
Unless there were 3 million that voted, in which case you are shy of about half a million Ohioans.
Yes.
Which is also a lot of Ohioans.
Yeah, we'll keep going. But just to context, this guy's going to run against, or is running for Senate and wants to be the Republican representative against Sherrod Brown.
Ah, interesting.
Yeah.
Free and fair election. We release the results on election night. That's this thing we do in Ohio. Other states should check out. Proud to say that as Ohio's chief elections officer. But you're right, the other side prevailed. This is just one battle in a much larger war, though, because the all-out assault on Ohio is coming from the radical left. I mean, look at the tech billionaires from California and New York that funded the No campaign, and they've got other bad plans. This radical abortion amendment this November that takes away parental rights. They want to bring a minimum wage increase, a massive increase in minimum wage to Ohio that would put Ohioans out of work. And even the mayor of Cleveland said last week, he said the quiet part out loud, they want to do common sense gun reform, which means they want to disarm law-abiding citizens. So, yeah, we lost one battle, but the war continues, and I've just begun to fight.
So, Frank.
I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm just completely out of touch, but telling Ohioans, you got to watch out because they're going to come and raise your minimum wage.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're letting the mask slip a little bit there when you know who he's truly representing is like the business elite or the small business owners.
What does he mean when he says tech billionaires or whatever? Bro, like, look at, if you're concerned about that, J.D. Vance is a Peter Thiel guy. Like,
but they're not. I mean, the reality is that the Republican side was the one benefiting most from this out-of-state money. There were billionaires.
Dick Uline.
Uline is right.
Flooding the zone for this.
Donated more than $5 million to this particular referendum, or not the referendum campaign, but the efforts to change the state constitution.
Oh, and they were getting robocalls from everyone from Carrie Lake to Mike Pence. I mean, they really flooded the zone. I think there was like slightly more money for the Vote No campaign, slightly. But I got news for you. There was not 57% to 43% more money,
right.
Not even remotely close. 3 million people, just to put this in context, in the 2022 election, granted an off-year election, J.D. Vance beats Tim Ryan, 4 million people voted. In this election, 3 million. To have like that number of people come out and vote on a random August day,
mm-hmm.
Is pretty stunning. And so, yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what happens when the radical left raises the minimum wage in Ohio, or when they try and I think you're going to start seeing a lot more of these referendums. And in fact, in Arizona,
mm-hmm.
the literally yesterday, as the results were coming in Ohio, there was a submission for a constitutional amendment in Arizona to protect abortion rights there. I think they have a ban on abortion now that's like a 12-week, I think it is. Maybe it's 16-week. I'm not 100% sure off the top of my head. But in Arizona, that vote theoretically would come up in 2024 in the general election. And that is both great strategy from a general election strategy and for a strategy for beating Kristen Sinema and Carrie Lake, who are going to be running against Gallego for senator out of Arizona. It's also a great strategy because Arizona is one of the swing states that's going to make a difference in the presidential election. And it's also a great strategy because all of that electioneering is also going to help if this amendment gets the signatures and is worded in the proper way, is going to help protect a woman's right to choose or a person who can get pregnant right to choose to end their pregnancy as opposed to be forced to give birth in those situations. So this is really encouraging, in an otherwise bleak you know, bleakness of climate change and whatever it is of the judiciary shutting down student debt relief and whatnot. But this is Ohio voters came out and were made a very, very large statement last night or yesterday, I should say. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Mo Tassick. She's the investigations editor at American Prospect. The American Prospect has put together the August issue is if you want to become somewhat of an expert, that's a bit of a hyperbole.
A wonk.
But if you really want to understand some of the key issues involved in why healthcare is so problematic in this country in terms of cost and delivery, do yourself a favor and go check out that issue. We're going to be talking to Mo about sort of a broad sweep of what they discussed in that issue in just a moment. We'll be right back after this. And just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you get the free show, free of commercials, and you get the fun half. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Okay, we'll be right back. We are back. Sorry for the delay. Had a little bit of technical difficulties. Sam Cedar, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Want to welcome back to the program Mo Tassick. She's the investigations editor at the American Prospect. And she has been writing a lot of stuff about healthcare, Mo, in this August 2023 issue of the Prospect magazine. I was just telling people before the break, and just to remind them, you guys have done essentially like a almost like a 360 of our healthcare delivery system and some of the real illnesses that are embedded within that system. Let's just start with an overview of everything, because you sort of cover like three or four major silos of the healthcare industry.
I think that the easiest way to think about our healthcare system is that it's an incredible crime story. And that's, you know, we've been writing a lot of stories in addition to the ones in this issue, kind of hitting at this fact. I think that one of the biggest problems with the healthcare journalism that you see in most mainstream outlets is that it takes the policy almost it's almost too well, good faith. You know, it takes the idea, that we're actually trying to improve healthcare, that we have institutions that, are built to improve healthcare outcomes and regulate, our healthcare institutions, sort of at face value, when actually the system was sort of, since at least the, you know, going back to at least like the 60s or 70s, it was kind of invented by crooks, and it was certainly perfected by crooks. And, you know, some of them were actual like all out mobsters, and others were just sort of, you know, very clever loophole exploiters and you know, white collar criminals. But there's just an incredible amount of activity, and you know, this is the reason it costs so much. There's so much involved in our healthcare system that makes money for it, that makes money for investors, is actually illegal, or you know, would be illegal if laws were enforced, and and it's that aspect to it that makes it so profitable. And these laws just simply, I mean, especially in the past 10 years, I would say, enforcement has been kind of at an all-time low. So what you get is just an incredible universe of middlemen that have figured out ways to extract a cut. You know, there's the patient, and there's the doctor and the nurse, and there's the, you know, hospital, there's equipment. And then in between all of that stuff, there's just this incredible universe of really profitable middlemen. And most of what they do is technically illegal because it doesn't add any value. It usually subtracts value. It makes it much more difficult for doctors to practice. It makes it much more difficult for nurses to save lives. And it's making us sicker. It is causing our life expectancies to plunge, and it is causing our, you know, our Medicare system to sort of be insolvent. And so that's really what we wanted to hit on, is what are all of these middlemen? And that's why we have one really big story that is dedicated to exploring United Healthcare. So basically that's essentially what the theme of the issue is about. And we'll be hitting on this a lot more, because the problem is that if you impose Medicare for all, if you try to impose sort of some, you know, well-meaning reform upon this system, it would only benefit the criminals who are making money off it right now. Most of our Medicare is going in the direction where most people with Medicare have Medicare Advantage plans. So it's a privatized system, and it's making a lot, you know, a small number of people extremely rich, and everyone else is getting sicker.
All right. And so, to be clear, so that people understand this, this is not about health insurance per se. The health insurance sort of rides on top. I'm not sure conceptually if it rides on top or on bottom, but it doesn't matter. It is a distinct sort of level of bureaucracy that we have now that certainly adds cost by the time it reaches, you know, I guess, the government's wallet or our wallet, or but it is not the fundamental, well, I should say, it's not the only, the exclusive problem, because as you say, we could have Medicare for all, which is an insurance solution, but we would still have this underlying system that is so problematic. Do you want to start with, is it easiest to start with United Healthcare? Because we should say also that the history of this was that the AMA, if my understanding is, for much of the first half and a little more of the 20th century, wanted to keep medicine from being corporatized, and really so that the profits would stay sort of like in these small businessmen, the doctors. And it created sort of a system that was really ripe to be corporatized and financialized and taken advantage of. And that started to happen as we get into the 70s and 80s and then more so into this century.
Right. If you looked at the AMA, if you look at the AMA back during, you know, most of the Cold War, that was the big healthcare monopoly. And they were an incredibly malevolent enterprise in a lot of ways. Their big enemy was socialized medicine, right? And they were one of the most powerful sort of anti-communist lobbies that existed. And they had one of the, you know, aspects of their power, that one of the things that made them so powerful was that to join the AMA, you had to join your county medical society. So there were 2,000 county and local medical societies, and they kind of ran the affairs of healthcare in whatever their county was. And most of the hospitals were county owned at the time. And this kept the AMA very powerful, keeping everybody else kind of small. Doctors were small. Group practice was shunned. Early HMOs were oftentimes sabotaged by the medical societies. They really wanted to keep the system in place. And what it did in hindsight, the benefit that this created to keep the AMA strong, they needed to keep doctors small and in their place. And so it was, they did create this situation where it was a very sustainable business model to just be a sole practitioner, to be a family doctor, to be in private practice. Then the HMO Act comes along in the 70s, and there's a lot of other things. First, the passage of Medicare was really important. And the fact that the AMA worked so hard when things like the Hill-Burton Act created most community hospitals, or funded most community hospitals in the 40s and 50s, the Medicare, you know, the creation of Medicare and Medicaid. But the actual way that these programs were designed was to keep the intrusion of the federal government extremely light. So when Medicare was created, it was sort of built on this Blue Cross system where you build Medicare for what you said that the cost of the care that you provided was, and they paid you for it. There was not a whole lot of utilization review. There was not a whole lot of what we consider to be regulation. Then in comes this thing called the HMO Act. And this is, the Nixon administration's desperate attempts to get healthcare costs under control after they passed Medicare and Medicaid. And it was designed by this guy named Paul Elwood, this consultant in Minnesota who had, you know, who really believed that you could unleash the powers of the free market to contain the cost of healthcare and incentivize healthcare providers to not overtreat patients, because that was a big problem at the time. You know, unnecessary hysterectomies and appendectomies were a big source of extra income to shady doctors. The HMO Act was supposed to kind of create a system of like Kaiser Permanentes, but instead it sort of created.
I know this is going to sound remedial, but will you just explain what a HMO is to people? Because I don't know that people know what a Kaiser Permanente is. I mean, I've been wading through this for 35 years, and I still can't quite figure out what's what.
Right. I think like the idea of it. So HMO is the health maintenance organization, and it's just one place. It's sort of a one-stop shop where you're supposed to take care of most of your medical needs for a flat fee by the month. And the idea is that all of the doctors work on a salary and nobody is incentivized to do unnecessary stuff. Give you unnecessary tests, do unnecessary surgeries, apply you with unnecessary drugs. And Kaiser
Permanente. And the HMO gets paid by essentially the insurance companies to be there and provide these services for their clients, essentially.
The HMOs were mostly established by, and they would get paid by the employer. So okay. Kaiser was formed by a steel company, Kaiser Steel. And they had a lot of steel mills and shipyards in areas that didn't have hospitals. So they're, the tycoon of Kaiser Steel decided to create his own sort of health care organization for his employees. And it worked actually pretty well, because in those days, all of his laborers were unionized. They were working for, him for likely 30 years. So he had this kind of, he really was incentivized to try and keep them healthy, keep their long-term healthcare costs down. He also wasn't as quite the asshole that you get in the healthcare industry today. By the time the HMO comes along, they've decided that they can do this system, they can do this health maintenance organization thing without putting it all under one roof, without making it look so much like a national health system or a walled garden the way that Kaiser is. And they basically just, it was created this new type of unregulated insurance that didn't have to, it was exempt from corporate practice of medicine laws in states. And it wasn't, the HMO Act that passed was very kind of, it was short, it was not particularly specific, and there was no funding. So it was sort of this idea that they wanted to let 100 flowers bloom. And they created this mandate where every employer had to set up an HMO and try and experiment with ways to deliver healthcare to employees that in a more cost-effective fashion. Well, Paul Elwood, the guy, the consultant who invented this whole thing and basically wrote the law, he had a protege, Richard Burke, and Richard Burke had a company called United Healthcare. And one of the things about, you know, most HMOs were supposed to be nonprofit. That was the whole idea, that they were going to be nonprofit. But there was this little loophole, and they said, well, maybe it's okay if a for-profit company comes in and runs the HMO. And, you know, before you know it, this guy, Richard Burke, is taking 17% of the revenues across the board, an unheard of amount, an unheard of take at the time in health insurance. There were a lot of Blue Cross systems in the 70s that took an overhead of 3%. So this was really kind of paving, you know, blazing new trails. And basically the business model was simple: pay doctors less, don't pay them at all if you can get away with it. And, you know, ration care, make it, much, much more difficult to access healthcare, just deny claims. And you can always make money that way. There's been, you know, many efforts to reform HMOs. And then at some point, I think sort of like leveraged buyouts became private equity. They dropped the HMO. The HMOs got very toxic in the media in the 90s because there were so many horror stories of people getting denied life-saving care by these HMOs. But essentially, that's still the system. They call them PPOs now, or they call them, you know, what have you. But essentially, if you can have your claim denied by your insurance company, which I think all of us can, it's an HMO in reality. And these systems, these insurance policies are regulated by ERISA, not by any sort of insurance regulator. And it's this whole, you know, it's this whole mess. But United Healthcare is really the Moby Dick, right? Of our corporate healthcare system. You know, they're the biggest employer of doctors right now. They control so many aspects of healthcare and healthcare delivery, and they make just an enormous, enormous amount of money. They make it extremely difficult for doctors to have a sustainable practice in almost any specialty these days, because they just lowball you. And so that's one of the big things that drove all this private equity investment in healthcare, was that private equity knew that they would have the leverage to negotiate with players as big as United Healthcare. And they get a lot of doctors in a lot of different specialties to sell out and immediately, you know, and so this is, you know, just one of the many different things that just by understanding United Healthcare, you can understand a lot of everything else that in the system that ails us.
Okay, and we should say that, you know, you have pieces on how the sort of like hedge funds and these type of outfits have influenced the emergency room. I guess there's a company, American Physician, parties, and then the family medicine sort of physician, or the disappearing family medicine physician, as well as Express Scripts, like that relationship between drug manufacturers, and by the time that we get to it. So, I mean, tell us about like the concept. I guess vertical integration is really, when you're talking about United Healthcare, that's what we're talking about, is this sort of where it's all lining up there. But where, like, how where does this sort of like new financialization that is coming in with these hedge funders, are they just replicating the United Healthcare model? Or are they almost like a different beast, but functioning in the same way?
Well, what you find you have to find loopholes, and in any system, I mean, United Healthcare, for instance, they have friends, they have ancillary businesses. There's a lot of conflicts of interest, so. One of my other stories is about basically really expensive, dubious drugs, or sometimes just really expensive drugs that are necessary, but they're obscenely expensive. The sort of the rise of six figure and now seven figure a year drugs, some of which are, vital life-saving pills that are just priced too high. Some of which are extremely dubious. And I focus on this one drug called Acthar, which was a big scandal a couple years back. It's $40,000 a vial. It's very it's a life-saving drug when it comes to infant epilepsy, but it was being prescribed all over the place for God knows what, any number of things. And why are we prescribing this very like dubious drug that is not FDA approved, off-label for, you know, multiple sclerosis and all of these other indications, when it costs, you know, $500,000 a year? Who's doing this? Who's allowing this? And if you really you know, probe this, and there's hundreds of drugs that are in this camp. What I learned was that of all people, Martin Shkreli actually was trying to bust this cartel back before he bought Daraprim and hiked the price of that drug. So famously, he was a short seller, and he and a lot of other short sellers specialized in shorting scammy pharma companies that he thought, and this was the scammiest of the scammy pharma companies, this company that made Acthar called QuestCore. And he had this, he decided he was going to kind of fund a, in addition to shorting QuestCore stock, he was going to fund an alternative to this scammy drug called Acthar, give it away for free and bust their business, and also, you know, be a good guy in the process. He went a different route, and the story is really interesting as to why. But ultimately, the mystery is, why did these drugs persist? And, you know, there's a lot of drugs like this. There's a drug that there's a deal that the FTC is trying to block right now, but Amgen Horizon merger. Horizon Pharmaceuticals is known, or Horizon Therapeutics is known for really scammy, really high-priced drugs. They sell a combination of Advil and Pepcid-AC, and then another drug that's similar, that's like a combination of Nexium and Aleve. And they sell these drugs for $3,000 a bottle. And the question is always, who's paying for this? Why is my, you know, endoscopy exam, or why is my colonoscopy exam being claimed being denied by my insurance company, but my insurance company at the same time is approving these claims for these absurd drugs that have no business sort of being in circulation even? And it goes back to these little understood entities called the pharmacy benefit managers, another kind of a middleman, right? That shouldn't exist, doesn't exist anywhere else. But these entities are owned by insurance companies. United Healthcare owns one, and Cigna owns the one that's the subject of our story, Express Scripts. And they have these ancillary businesses that kind of specialize in high-priced drugs, like Acthar or, you know, Actimmune. There's all kinds of orphan drugs.
So wait, the PBMs own these, are basically owned by the same entities that own these drugs, or
they're the distributors, and they make a cut.
Okay. And they make a cut.
Closing
and
so it's all. It's a very, you know, but when you find out, so essentially it's conflicts of interest, right? That are generating all this money. And
if you get a percentage of a high-priced drug,
yes,
and you're the guy who's responsible for saying to different entities, whether they're hospitals or pharmacies, I've got two drugs for this, you're going to push right. The high-priced one, because of course it puts more money in your pocket. That's like, exactly. it's just basic math, essentially. So, all right, so let me ask you this. We have all these middlemen who have come in. We have the financialization of these, a lot of things, of hospitals and hospital groups. We have hospital groups being diminished and being replaced with telemedicine. We have all of these different things. What are the key laws that are on the books that exist today that could be implemented to sort of fix some of these problems? Or are they, you know, and I assume they're in the, like, sort of the antitrust and anti-competitive realm, or other laws, or are there any other proposals that are out there to sort of like, here's three right. laws that are going to hit these different sections of the way that our medicine's delivered, essentially?
So I think that the biggest area really is the Medicare fraud laws. Right. We don't really enforce our Medicare fraud laws. Our primary mode of enforcement is something called the QTOM system, is we, you know, we allow employees of companies that are doing Medicare fraud to file these whistleblower lawsuits. And occasionally the DOJ will intervene in a lawsuit and, you know, have the employee wear a wire and get, you know, into it, and ultimately what usually happens, almost always happens, if the DOJ actually does intervene, is the company agrees to pay a settlement. The settlement is almost always a tiny fraction of the amount that was actually stolen from the system. And the DOJ increasingly just doesn't intervene in cases. And it must be a problem of resources. A lot of it is also, I think, a cultural problem. But this is a huge issue. Hundreds of billions of dollars are going missing from our, you know, healthcare system in fraud and abuse. And we're clawing back like $5 billion in a good year. So those laws need to be strengthened. In the 90s, we had thousands of FBI agents working Medicare fraud cases. That is just not happening now. And it's creating the situation where it's impossible to be an honest healthcare provider. It's kind of like the crooks, the mafia dons are really, you know, they're the ones who know how to work the system. So I think that is the biggest thing, is just, and it's boring to say we need more enforcement. We need to enforce those laws that are on the books, but this would definitely deter a lot of behavior. In the realm of private equity taking over medicine, you know, medical practices, there are laws called corporate practice of medicine laws on the books in most states, pretty strong ones on the books in 30 states. These laws are not enforced. The enforcement is complicated because it involves these non-governmental bodies, the medical boards of states. But a lot of doctors have really started, you know, brushing off these statutes and saying, hey, like, isn't, you know, if we enforce this law, wouldn't my practice be illegal? Wouldn't, you know, the hospital down the street that's hiring nurse practitioners and telling them that they have to, you know, run all of these unnecessary tests on every patient in the ER waiting room if they have good enough insurance, isn't that illegal? A lot of things would be illegal if these statutes were enforced. And a year ago, I would have said corporate practice of medicine laws, those have never been enforced. When they have been enforced, it's usually been for bad. But doctors really have embraced this, especially in the emergency medicine field. And I think that where you get a lot of highly educated, highly motivated people in, you know, trying to get into the system and trying to change it, you know, that's where we're likely to see the most reform is in avenues like that. So I'm definitely looking a lot at corporate practice of medicine laws. They've been undermined by the FTC in a lot of with a lot of decisions that they've made, and I think that today's FTC is likely to take to be much more helpful, much more encouraging about how these laws could actually really help competition in medicine. But that's probably another avenue. Otherwise, well, it's, yeah, we need.
A lot of this sounds to me sort of like where we were talking about antitrust in like 2015 and 2014, where there was a growing understanding that a lot of what was inhibiting the economy and hurting the economy was this sort of like increasingly concentration of corporate power, corporate and wealth. And it was a burgeoning sort of like movement. This feels like something that in a second term of a Biden administration is going to get a lot more attention. But in the meantime, it really is the whole magazine, or at least what I've read from it, and the work that you've done here, really, really impressive. If folks want to understand these problems, this is the best place to start. Mo Tassick, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. We'll put links to all of this in this month's episode. Edition of the American Prospect. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, Nicole Sorrell will be here. She is an audio description narrator and a member of the SAG-AFTRA negotiating committee. It is day 26 of the SAG-AFTRA strike, day 100 of the WGA strike. We're going to get an update on what's been happening, what the issues are, and more. We'll be right back after this. We're back. Sam Cedar, Emma Viglin on the Majority Report. Let me just say, what I meant to say when we left for the break was we're going to put links to that this edition of the August magazine of the American Prospect and all of these articles in today's episode of our podcast and YouTube descriptions. I'm having a rolling stroke. I don't know what to say. It's been happening for like 2 weeks. Joining us on the program, Nicole Sorrell. She is an audio description narrator, a member of the SAG-AFTRA Negotiating Committee, chair of the Los Angeles Performers of Disability Committee. I appreciate you joining us. Right about now, I think, or maybe like 20 minutes ago, is when the picket lines opened up in L.A., I believe. They're just closed in New York. Full disclosure, I'm a member of SAG-AFTRA, just to say that so that people know my biases. But I have, I don't think people, if people paid attention, I think they would have picked up on that. Nicole, give us a, we've talked about this on the program, but give us a brief rundown of what the major issues are for SAG-AFTRA. We can expand that a little bit to the extent that you're aware of in terms of the WGA, but just give us those sort of like the bullet points that are the big issues.
Okay. Well, first, thank you for having me on the show. And, you know, what we're really asking for is dignity and respect and to be treated fairly in our industry and to continue to be able to have a career in this industry. To that end, we need to raise our minimums. Our minimum pay right now, the raise that they're offering us at this point, would mean that we would be making in real dollar value 5% less than we made in 2020. Our dollar would go so much less than it did then, and it's already difficult to feed our families on what we make. As you heard, I've seen, you know, you had Andrew Leeds on the show, and I've seen you guys talk about the fact that 26% or $26,000 is what we need to qualify for healthcare, and 87% of our members do not qualify for healthcare.
It's insane.
And talk, if you will, about how the industry has changed. Back when I was doing sitcoms, it was very straightforward stuff. You had, at that time, five networks, the studios, and I was doing this when the Sin-Fin laws were, or the Fin-Sin laws were rescinded. And basically, studio would hire you. They would sell the show to the network. The network would play it for, you know, if it got to four seasons or five seasons, the studio would then sell it in syndication. If it went on like that, you would get residuals. And so if you did a show that was getting residuals, it would take you through the lean times because, you know, I'm known as the dad and I'm not going to, maybe I may not get another job because I'm so well known as the dad. I can get one job here for a day or two. But that all changed with streaming. And walk us through that change.
Sure. So as you mentioned, we used to have linear network TV where we had 20 some episodes a season. And then you had the summer off and maybe you did a movie, maybe you didn't, maybe you took summer off with your kids, but you were able to sustain through residuals and that, as you mentioned, magical syndication. Where we are now is that magical syndication is move over to streaming. Mm-hmm. And as they do, well, we don't know what streaming's going to pay, so please help us out. That's not how you run a business. You take on that risk, but they put it on us. So now with streaming, we don't get those residuals. And I hope you guys have seen a lot of actors that you recognize have been very open on social media now with their residual checks for pennies and some for negative pennies. So now when it moves over to streaming, we're not making money. The cast of Stranger Things has other jobs and it's one of the biggest shows on Netflix. So one of the key things that we're asking for, or demanding, I should say, is revenue share. We are building your platforms. We are the reason that your platforms are growing and worth billions of dollars. And we're getting pennies.
What has like the studio's kind of explanation been to you guys in the sense of like their lack of transparency about how many people are actually watching this stuff?
Right. So they have never been upfront with that when it comes to streaming. And they really haven't communicated with us on this issue. So when we went into negotiations, they dealt with the smaller issues. And as Fran has spoken in interviews saying, we thought we were going to deal with the smaller issues and then get to the bigger things. They refused to engage. They absolutely refused to engage on this topic. We're asking for 2% of revenue share. 2%. It's such a small number for them, and they refuse to give us that information.
And it seems to me, I mean, there's a lot of different ways in which they could do this. I mean, they certainly know if they don't want to share with people like how well a specific show is doing, which they're probably, I mean, you know, I have no doubt that it's less than people generally think. Stranger Things, extremely popular show, but it's not MASH from 1987 or something. I mean, it may be, but highly unlikely. And so they have their own metrics as to what the value of any given show is. But we know what their revenue is on any given year, right? Because it's X time, whatever, it's $10 a month, let's say, for Netflix. They've got 1 million subscribers. Right. You know, then we know that it's like $120 million a year or something. What has the, you know, like how much has the discussion been like, okay, look, you don't want to tell us what the numbers are because you're afraid that's going to tank your stock options and Sarandos or whomever it is. That's how you get paid. Fine. You can maintain that fiction if you want, but you need to come up with a system that will obscure you. And you can make it up if you want. If you want to say like, you know, but this is the minimum of the share from all the shows on your platform. You divide it up that way. If you want to give a bonus to some, you know, to, that hit some benchmark that you make up in your head. I mean, can they do that? Is that, or are they just refusing to do, to just share this money in any way, shape or form?
Well, yes, they're refusing to share this money in any way, shape or form, but they already have the analytics with third-party companies. And we've been open about it. There's a company called Parrot Analytics. And these platforms hire Parrot to analyze what a show is bringing to their platform. So they have all the metrics. They know if we put this on, if we put Friends on for, you know, this month, that's going to be the big boost to get subscribers. Then we can pull it off and we can put it back on X amount of months later to then again get that boost. They know all that. And using companies like Parrot, we would have access to that information, and therefore we would be able to equitably divide it up based on performance. And when you're talking about, you know, MASH, that was based on the commercial ad reps, right? So we're just shifting where that revenue is coming from for how we do that calculus, and they're refusing to engage.
What's incredible is that this data should be even more straightforward than like the Nielsen rate, or, you know, whatever the systems were previously to gauge viewership that would then drive advertising. Because all of this data has to be tabulated, I mean, as easily as possible, just given the fact that it's all computerized at this point.
Well, they know, but it's really a question of like if the Nathan Fielder show doesn't necessarily have a lot of viewers, but there's a lot of people writing about it, then you subscribe to the service because the service is in there. So there's a lot of loss leader in this, but nevertheless, there is a metric for this. They know the value of these shows to them. That's how they run their business. It doesn't necessarily ascribe to X number of viewers. It's a combination. Gotcha. So let me ask you this other question. There was a time where the producers were largely, not exactly, but their incentive structure and their business model was aligned. But now you have like old Hollywood models and these sort of more tech models with the streaming. Is this, from your perspective, an opportunity where they're going to have less sort of durability in hanging out, like where in terms of like this, this is going to be a really long, I think, battle. But their cohesion, do you anticipate that they're going to start maybe to pull apart a little bit? Because Netflix may have a different agenda than Amazon, and Amazon may have a different agenda than Hulu because of the way that their models are different. And they all have a very different model than, say, like, you know, I don't know, maybe Paramount, unless, you know, depending on which one is put which eggs in which basket.
Well, you said something a minute ago that really speaks to this, is that they're working for their shareholders. They're not, you know, the model has changed to that degree that they're looking for their bottom line to make their bonuses for their shareholders. The audience doesn't play as much of a role, and our participation doesn't play as much of a role. So when you talk about these streamers and network having a different business model and will they split, I don't know. We're not in their room. We can't hear them talk. There are reasons that that makes sense, and there are reasons that they might not choose to do it. But when you talk about how long this strike might go, if we were back in linear, we know that if we're not back to work by Labor Day, we're not having a fall network. We're not having a fall season. And when you're talking about streaming, which puts us into a whole nother issue that we're working on in the room, it's that they're not functioning under a set structure. So you have actors who are leads on shows that work 6 to 10 episodes, and they may not go back to work for 18 months, but they're held on exclusivity. So that makes it harder for us to make a living because they're exclusive and they're only working 10 shows in 2 years. But also it changes where their needs are for how fast they want to end this strike.
Right.
Because we don't know what do they value Oscar season? Do they value the Christmas movie? Do they value linear network, you know, fall season? At this point, we're waiting to find out.
And is one of the terms, I mean, that issue of like shows, you know, the way that they develop shows and the way they commit to shows has changed dramatically from the linear days, as you call them. But the holds on actors and frankly on writers hasn't seemed to have changed at all. And you know, there's different issues in terms of like actors and writers, because, you know, if you can get an actor, you're going to shoot with them next week. You got them. They're on, you know, with a writer, you need a certain more lead time and anticipation associated. So slightly different issues, but, for SAG-AFTRA, is this question of like exclusivity or terms or pay to play, are these, in the mix as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Holding actors exclusivity, like I said, for up to 18 months is untenable. We can't afford to feed our families on that, right? So that is absolutely part of our negotiation. Again, it's dignity and respect. Treating us with dignity and respect. Look, as you mentioned, I'm the chair of the Performers with Disabilities Committee in Los Angeles, and I'm a voiceover artist, partly because they don't hire people with disabilities. Like, we're 25% of the population. We are 3% of scripted characters. Of that 3%, and I'm about to tell you, only 2% of those are played by disabled actors, and that's because things are getting better. That's how small the number is of getting better. And a lot of times you'll hear, well, they're not written. Okay, it doesn't have to be written. Does it matter if the three of us sitting here, if any of us are disabled? No. I mean, I am. I walk with a cane or sometimes use a wheelchair, but it doesn't have any bearing on sitting here doing this show. So they don't look at that. They don't look at those opportunities, and that just is the canary in the coal mine about dignity and respect and how they don't treat us with it, right? When we talk about audio description, the voiceover work that I do, because people with disabilities get more voiceover work, audio description is absolutely covered under our contract, but the AMPTP refuses to acknowledge it, and we are insisting that they do.
Let's talk briefly about interim agreements. There's a little bit of, and this may be a little bit of inside baseball, but I don't think it's too inside baseball. In fact, I just got an email as a member of SAG-AFTRA that there's going to be a webinar tomorrow, I think, about interim agreements. But explain what these are, because there are, you know, folks have been publicly saying, you know, asking questions like, is this helpful? Explain to us what interim agreements are, and then let's talk about, you know, to the extent that there's controversy, is the questions of, is it helpful? Does it maintain solidarity, et cetera?
Absolutely. So the interim agreement is a contract that can be used right now, and it's the terms from the last time we pushed across the table. So the last package that we said, here's our responses, here's where we want it, the 11% minimums increase, for example. That's what that interim agreement is. So when we say you can apply for an interim agreement, our staff will then go through with the applications and make sure that none of the projects are connected to the AMPTP. They are truly independents. And when they go through that, then they go through our normal vetting process to get approved by SAG, and then they have an interim agreement. And they're working under the contract that we put across the table to the AMPTP that they refused on the final night, July 12th. So they're working under that interim agreement with all the pieces there, the change in exclusivity, the revenue share, all of those pieces are included in that. So that shows the industry that these contracts are tenable.
They're not so onerous that they can't be implemented. Well, what of the argument that when you do that, though, because they may be independent, but ultimately they're going to sell to somebody and they're going to end up being on, you know, running on Hulu or Amazon or Apple or Netflix or whatever it is. What about like sort of the calculation that A, it decreases leverage because it's providing content for these platforms, and B, it makes it harder to maintain solidarity amongst all of SAG-AFTRA workers because they're not all, you know, you're talking about a limited number of people, and there are a certain amount of like stars and names who are not going to be on the picket lines because they're going to be working on these productions.
Well, I understand that, and I think that's just from lack of information. And to that end, we probably should have had this webinar a little earlier than we are having it tomorrow. But keep in mind, the revenue share is additive, so we have also asked for increases in streaming residuals. All of that applies. So if and when they do sell those projects to streaming, those residuals, that revenue share still applies. So if they choose to buy it, they then choose to air it. They are agreeing to those pieces that we put in. They can't just air
the streaming
it under
the old platforms.
Term.
The streaming platforms themselves are essentially agreeing to the terms, and they're basically showing that we can theoretically agree to these terms, or not even theoretically, I guess, literally agree to these terms for this amount of shows. And so we have the ability to do this stuff.
Absolutely. And these are truly independent projects. So, yes, there are names that work, but there's more so not names that are working. Your actors that, you know, are the journeyman, the struggling actor, they're working on these projects. Imagine, you know, you have one name on a film, maybe two, and all the rest of those actors are working. All the rest of those writers, you know, are getting paid for their script. All the rest of the crew that is put out of work right now because we're on strike, they're getting jobs from this. So, you know, when we talk about the residual change, my neighbor is an actor that you would all recognize from shows you love, like Superstore. And he's slinging pizza because of how much our industry has changed.
Yeah, it's amazing. And just talk for a moment. You know, we have recently had a Yahtzee members that was on live productions unionize. But the idea that the WGA is out there on the picket lines with the actors, it's been a long time since SAG-AFTRA been real. I mean, you know, for an extended strike like this, I think we're now at like 40 years or something, maybe more actually. The writers 15 years ago or so, but the writers were, it seemed to me, were not as cohesive as they are today. And just the sort of the labor movement itself, at least within the context of Hollywood, was not as cohesive as it is today. On Friday of last week, the producers met with the writers, and there was it really felt like they were trying to sort of like drive a wedge, like force the writers to say that we will not go back until SAG-AFTRA is resolved, which it seemed to me, and this was all leaked by the producers, it seemed to me to be a technique to try and create dissent within the WGA. What is your sense of both the solidarity that you're seeing from the writers and just sort of like how much solidarity you're seeing just within both unions?
Yeah, it's amazing. We haven't had a big strike on this contract or any strike since the 80s. And when you talk about the writers and the actors out together, that was 1960. That's when we got residuals, pension, and health. So it's been a long time, and they were very powerful when it happened. The playbook of the AMPTP seems to be to try to divide. They did that with their offers to us, try and divide our groups. And as the writers have said, we're the same. We're not making a deal that leaves any of our membership behind. We're not going to make a deal that helps most of our union, but not all of our union. And they try to divide us now with the writers, and it's not going to work. It's such a beautiful thing. You know, first of all, from our group, Fran Drescher is an incredible leader. What I love about Fran is that she's doing the right thing simply because she believes it's the right thing. It doesn't matter what she thinks it may or may not do to her career. It is literally to help everyone. And Duncan Crabtree Ireland is incredible to watch as our lead negotiator. So our room, our negotiating committee is in lockstep with each other constantly. Our unity is fierce. When they tried to separate us by groups, by offering certain things to some parts of our membership and not to others, we all stood together. You know, as I mentioned, I'm very active in audio description, and we're all in that together, even though I'm the main person on our committee about it. And you have to ask, just as a side note about audio description, it's like, if you were to hire me to read to your kids, would you pay me less because your kids are blind? That's what the AMPTP thinks, right? So where's their respect for just individuals? Now, as far as on the line, it is incredible. You see videos and photos of us laughing and smiling and doing karaoke on the picket line. It's not because we want to be on strike. This was a last call. This is because we had to. We had no option. So what do? We're making the best of it. And the writers, you know, some writer friends of mine tell me the shot in the arm of just the sheer volume of actors that have joined on the line, it's creating more of a unity. And I think the more they let us create that bond, the harder it's going to be for them to break us ever. I think this is creating a whole new hot labor summer, you know, a whole new community in our industry that is going to be hard to break moving forward.
That's a really interesting point. I mean, I've experienced it firsthand just personally, but it hadn't really occurred to me the implications of it on a broader scale, that that opportunity. Just you got writers and actors socializing in a way that, you know, writers don't, they don't socialize them. Nicole Sorrell, audio description narrator, a member of SAG-AFTRA, negotiating committee and chair of the Los Angeles Performers Disability Committee. Thanks so much for your time today. People can go to SAG-AFTRA-strike.org, and it will provide information as to where the picket lines are. I can say, just as having been on those picket lines, when people drive by and honk their horns, people, you really can't appreciate how much the people who are picketing enjoy people blaring their horns, because it just amplifies their voices. So go out there, you know, bring a pizza or some water or just honk your horn. But I really appreciate your time, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Nicole.
Thanks for having me.
All right, folks. Quick break, head into the fun half of the program. Number 646-257-3920 is the number. Just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member and join themajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get the the free half free of commercials, you get the fun half. And you can IM the show. I will say this. We keep getting spammed. I'm going to read this once.
Okay.
And then I'm going to tell this person, do not keep sending it. For Sam, it's pronounced Nabikitendo. Hi, I'm new here. I hope this works. We've read this, IM, like 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. I'd recommend you have on Andrew Seidel. He's a constitutional attorney, wrote the book American Crusade, How the Supreme Court is Weaponizing Religious Freedom. We have that down, right?
We have good news for you.
Oh, we're doing it this afternoon.
Yes,
oh.
We're doing a pre-record, right?
Yes.
So that interview is coming.
It's literally booked. It's coming in a week. I thought we were doing somebody different for that pre-record. Okay. So do not, under any circumstances, tweet us the same, or IM us the same IM 30 times.
Yes.
Because if it's effective in catching our eye, it will also be incredibly irritating, and I will literally, I don't know how we could ever do this in terms of blocking somebody on our IM, but we will develop a technology.
Yes.
Well, we should probably not tell people that we can't do that.
Good point.
I mean, or theoretically, we can do it.
And if we hadn't had Andrew booked for the pre-record today, then honestly, based on your spamming, we might have been like...
Maybe we should cancel anyway.
We might have just... Yeah, right.
Sorry! Sorry.
Not done enough.
One of your fans at Partisans is too annoying.
Nabiki Tendo said it too many times, so we got to cancel you. I'm warning folks right now. I just saw that I got a text from Kyle. And so when I see a text from Kyle with that type of when I say something technical, it means that he's already figured it out.
Oh.
It means that he's like, it takes Kyle like 30 seconds, sometimes less.
All right.
To figure out any major technical problem.
Our finger is over the button, Nabiki Tendo.
JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Emma.
Mm-hmm.
ESVN.
We spoke about the U.S. Women's National Team's loss and the Patriots, like Trump and Benny Johnson and Charlie Kirk cheering that on just because they're essentially women. We also reviewed the Netflix quarterback series, which was phenomenal, and gave some of our picks for rookie fantasy sleepers ahead of the season, youtube.com/ESPN show.
You know, you got to talk about next week. Oh, you can talk about whatever you want. But this whole thing where ESPN now and the sports thing.
I do. Yeah, I want to.
Seems a little problematic.
We're going to, I mean, look, I was a little dazzled by the ability to bet on my phone when this first started to come out. But Matt, I remember at the time said
it's gonna be like the 20s again.
It's really bad.
There's gonna be a major scandal. It's gonna blow up in everyone's face.
But I mean, like, never mind a major scandal, like if you are if you are a network that powerful in terms of influencing fans and owners, and you own some betting, like, you're gonna,
oh no, there's massive issues.
It's ridiculous that they're sitting Jaylen Brown. I mean, this is the big game. Mm-hmm. They gotta play him, blah blah blah.
Yeah,
but you get because you wanted to drive bets. There seems to be a lot of,
and the players are bearing the brunt of this. Yes. And yet, like, the owners can get as rich as they want off of this.
There's already been like multiple altercations with players and fans. Like, Bradley Beal got an altercation. One guy like bought a ticket to basically chew out Bradley Beal, saying, "You cost me money." Mm-hmm. And then they got an altercation as Bradley Beal tried to like leave the arena. Like, gambling, I don't like it. I think it should be banned, at least it should not be encouraged by these major institutions like the leagues themselves or ESPN. Like, it's
not encouraged. They now own,
right? Exactly,
starting their own book.
They have a financial interest in people betting, which is, you know,
sick.
It's a problem.
I mean, if you watch a game, and these regional sports networks are like struggling, like MSG is trying to get me to pay $30 a month to
just you.
Well, anybody. I mean, I haven't cut the cord yet for that reason, because, like, honestly, the collection of sports packages you would need to watch things legally, it's just insane. Versus
I don't
just
even
watching
know what
on
that
cable.
Means.
Yeah, I mean, just like the streaming for these sports for sports now is insane. But we also, next week, we'll definitely talk about the Orioles announcer who was retaliatorily fired. But Left Reckoning, Matt. Sorry.
Left Reckoning. We had Cale Brooks on, talk about degrowth, and also in the post game, which you can get at patreon.com/LeftReckoning. I got really angry at a guy I'm calling Parasite Bet David, because he had this 6-minute clip where him and his loser friends were talking about how UPS drivers were getting paid too much. And I thought, like, one, like, it's one thing to, like, make a bunch of money, like, in stock trading or flipping houses. Like, you're still a parasite, but, like, at least it's, like... But it turns out that he's a Martha-level marketing guy.
This is the guy I went on his show down in Florida.
And when you went on, I'm like, I'm assuming he made money in Wall Street or something like that. And it's like, he made money with this thing called PHP, which is, like, scamming guys into becoming insurance salesmen for him, but they have to buy insurance. It's like for
it's
like low level MLM pyramid
scheme.
And I just, the gall of certain people, like the people who just buy and sell, even if it's stocks, like, you need to shut up about the people that actually work for a living in this country.
Well, I'll tell you what is also fascinating is you have these guys like him and Rogan who ostensibly, you know, have this sort of like aesthetic of appealing to the working class, but if you don't make $3 million a year, you're an idiot.
Yes.
And you don't know what you're talking about.
Well, this is my
if you're actually, you know, you're out there delivering the thing, he'd be happy to have a muffin basket, you know, for him. Like, hey guys, thanks for sending me my packages during the COVID. Mm-hmm. But if they start making any money at the end of their careers, like,
But it's also like, yeah, I don't know how these guys, and it's like Rogan, him, like the entire like manosphere type of Andrew Tate. To me, like my project is defining all of this as actually unmanly. Passive income, the idea that like you're going to get ahead because of passively, because you're going to buy and sell, you're going to drop ship, you're going to like skim off the top of stuff, is to me so sick that that's been like put forward as this model of masculinity. Mm-hmm. Like that's, I think it's the exact opposite.
Passive income is,
it's gross.
Not like, manly.
It should be taxed like 99%. Like this idea that like Patrick Bet David or all these guys be like, I know how to. Patrick Bet David talks about how he invests in sports cars. Like, do you know what sports cars do? They don't appreciate in value.
Yeah.
Like, it's insane to me. I can't believe that this is put forward as like the model. And then like guys coming together who drive trucks and carry heavy packages all day, getting six figures at the high end of the scale, like that's put forward as some crisis.
Like a guy, I don't recognize who the guy is, but some tech guy who was breaking down, you know,
Calacanis, who's like, yeah, how much can they deliver 5 to 10 packages?
Yes,
an
exactly.
Hour?
And it like, turns out, like, well, you're off by a factor of 10.
Oh my God, really? A factor of 10?
We talked about that in the post game as well.
He's
like, I'm going to do some math here. It's like, how about like do any research before?
Exactly.
But he's a venture capitalist and a startup guy. Ostensibly, he should know what he's doing when regards to like doing napkin math on a business, but
he should,
no idea.
Right, right. Well, like, the math is secondary to the not understanding what working people are going through.
Yeah, it's like Jessica Walter at Arrested Development being like, what is a banana cost? What could a banana cost?
$10?
Yeah, right.
How much could they deliver 5 to 10 packages? It's like, first of all, he thinks of it just like Santa Claus, like for in his like gated community, like how much are they bringing me? Like most of these guys are delivering to like addresses where they're not only delivering things like big old brown Santa Clauses, they're also picking up packages to deliver elsewhere. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah.
Jesus.
Yeah.
That's pretty much what I said last night.
Yeah, well, people should still tune in.
We're going to take a brief nap, and we'll see you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, no. Who sent us this?
Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back.
Snowflakes has what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare!
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black African. And the alpha males are black. And the Africans are back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle.
Come on! Fuck.
fuck them. Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan. By the way, it's my birthday. My birthday. Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on. Come on. Come on. Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total pussy.
Let's go to the IMs. Oh, it's the fun half, ladies and gentlemen. Yes. Sam, after watching that video of the brawl in Alabama for the 100th time, all I can think about is that time Tucker Carlson said white people would never gang up on someone in a fight. Curious.
Oh, right. Yeah, that was, I finally got the chance to watch that. It was electric.
White men don't fight like that, is what he said.
Oh,
which
right.
is just an insane, I mean, that's just like a...
We should dig that up and just, we should, like, put that underneath the, as an audio, as like a soundtrack for that.
Mm-hmm.
Fart Twain. We have been experiencing some effects from climate change here in Southeast Alaska. For the 12th year in a row, a glacier had a lake build up from melting. Then it broke free, causing quite a bit of flooding this year.
I saw that.
Two houses fell into a river, and two new apartment buildings are now uninhabitable. Yes, I saw that up in Juneau. I think we headlined that yesterday.
But I guess those houses, you could just resell them.
Uranium interests. Sorry for last. I am Hannah from yesterday is actually a paid policy advisor for ECFR, a EU think tank with XPMs, NATO, secretaries and leaders as member. Did you know that when you introduced her as just a conflict analyst or whatever? Did you know that she's no longer a paid, she no longer is paid from there? She was a visiting fellow with the Africa program. I'm going to read from her thing. On the European Council of Foreign Relations, she's a writer and policy advisor with over a decade of field-based experience in peace and security research, advocacy, North Africa and Sahel, as an international crisis group senior, blah, blah, blah. She was. I don't know what else to say. She was a visiting fellow there, but allow me to read. No wonder she had great things to say about the unseated president, who is a darling of European West. Unseated president? I mean, first off, I don't think she had great things to say about it. I think she said he was a mixed bag and he was largely unpopular. I think she did say that he was the winner of a relatively somewhat dubious democratic election.
As opposed to a coup, which is what happened. A coup happened. That's what the
fuck unseated is a weird way. I mean, it's a coup.
Passive.
You may find like that it's legit in your calculation, which is fine. Honestly, I'm completely agnostic.
The IMR doesn't quote anything that was actually said or just characterizes it. Generally.
She even advocated strategic military ties. Please do more research about your guests and introduce them their interests better. Okay.
Strategic military.
Did you have a guest that you wanted us to interview on that? Silly. She was a fellow of that group. I'm sure she was a lot of things. We didn't bring them all in there. But enjoyed Matt articulating parasitic masculinity, says Dick Durbin superfan. Mm. Santos Becada. Should search Patrick Bet David painting. Watch out. He knows some important people. I'm not sure I follow it.
You should start a podcast called Remasculated.
Thanks for the suggestion.
Emma said leave the office because of all the pizza talk that we did during the SAG after.
I'm so hungry.
I mean, half that interview was about deep dish or thin crust.
Emma got up there and was like, all that pizza talk, it's got me hungry.
I'm like control effing the transcript.
What are you talking about? Pizza talk? The word pizza was said once.
I'm going to get a slice of pizza.
You dared breathe the word pizza.
It was my internal mental dialogue, which just went pizza, 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 pizza from that period on.
Courier 11 second. Adam Kroll is the perfect distillation of fake blue collar celeb guy. Was helper for 6 months in construction in the 80s and has represented himself as a skilled and experienced craftsman ever since, when not making women jump on a trampoline.
Yeah, he might be. I'm not sure what his actual like background was growing up, but he does have a part of his origin story. I think that was in the Prager documentary that he did, was that a woman was chosen as like a firefighter over him. And, you know, that sort of set him on the trajectory that he is now. Because how could a woman be a better firefighter than Adam Carolla?
Yeah, that brainiac. Unbelievable.
I love those niche moments where, like, these personal slights reveal that cause too much. People to just, like, go down the reactionary path. Yeah, reveal, right. Yeah. Well,
99 problems, but a Finch ain't one. It's very refreshing to hear y'all reference the crew when speaking about the WGA SAG after strike. It's a misconception to say that the hardships of the strike started in May. I work in construction. My partner is a set decorator buyer, and my roommate is in props. Since October of last year, I can attest, the entire industry where I live has slowed down dramatically. Yeah, I've heard that from friends who work in production in both L.A. and New York, and witnessed it, frankly. My brothers, sisters, and kin who built, light, and dress the sets have been struggling for nearly a year now, and outside y'all's coverage, we haven't been acknowledged. I can only assume that the studios held off on greenlighting new projects that would extend past May, without a doubt. I apologize, such a long message. Haven't been commented on the struggles felt by so many in the small business communities around the film city hubs. Film industry affects the lives of so many people other than a few movie stars, and that's what the AMPT is trying to discredit. Left is best, without a doubt. 100%. Let's talk a little bit more about the Ohio issue one, which was ostensibly about raising the threshold for citizens who are voting on an amendment to the Constitution. It was in part, or a large part, was to prevent the citizens of Ohio from voting on an amendment to protect a person's right to choose whether they will maintain a pregnancy through to birth. But the Republicans in Ohio also know that the radical left wants to do things like raise the minimum wage for the first time in, what is it, God knows how many years in Ohio. Decades, I think it is.
I'm not sure.
They want to do other crazy-ass things like that, like protect people's rights. The money... there was more money in there to defeat this ballot measure than against, but it wasn't a huge disparity. But what's really interesting is the means in which they advertised. I just sent you a tweet, Bradley, in the look at like some of the mailers that they were using. Because, again, you know, one of the issues that we've been told is that the reason why you should not hesitate to weigh in on the conservative-generated attacks against trans people is because it's a losing issue for Democrats, and et cetera, et cetera. This is just purely an electoral calculation. Now, without litigating the question as to whether you should determine your, protecting people's civil liberties should be a function of an electoral calculation. Okay. Putting that aside. And if anybody sort of errs on the side of not being a moralist, it would be me. But part of my politics are you try and protect the most marginalized and really the politically weakest people in a society, because that ends up being the baseline for everybody. But putting that aside, let's just look at the question about the political salience, again, of the right-wing transphobia hysteria. I don't even know what else to call it. They spent $50 million in Michigan in 2022, pushing transphobic advertising and they got decimated in Michigan. And then, I mean, they're so pathological about this. Here is, you put this up on the screen. Pro-issue site, oh, I'm sorry, hold off on that. Just let's see the tweet here. The pro-issue one side throwing his absolute slop against the wall and hoping it sticks in the closing days. This person says sad part is it'll work on some folks. They were wrong. Well, maybe it did, but it didn't work.
Not
on
enough.
That.
Yeah.
But put this up here. Your toy dog is cute, but it can't keep you safe. It's shocking. What? And right. Radical liberal special interest groups are trying to hijack Ohio's constitution to impose. There's a picture of a drag queen. Radical trans ideology in our schools. Sex change operations for kids without any parental involvement. Abortion on demand, even in the 40th week of pregnancy. Destroy the rights of parents to protect their own children. I mean, this is what they've been leading with. Literally, what they lead with.
I also saw Mike Pence had an ad, or he had a statement that he put out on his YouTube channel saying something very similar the morning of, you have to protect the children from the trans ideology. So this was like a last-minute, last-ditch effort to make it about more than just abortion.
Let's look at a YouTube ad that they had, that they were running, and I think this one ran...
Protect Women Ohio.
Yep. Protect Women Ohio. Here it is.
You promised you'd keep the bad guys away. Protect her. Now's your chance. Out-of-state special interests that put trans ideology
Pause
in classrooms.
It. Pause it for 1 second. Just so you know, if you're listening, on the TV, there's, you know, the gender unicorn is on the TV. They're looking at the, I guess they're watching Fox News, the nightly transphobic report on Fox News.
Yeah.
And, but
let me just say one thing, too. Notice how so much of, like, the paternalism in this is just... like, really kind of creepy, I would say, the protection of your daughter. It's like, this is all designed to appeal to the guys that show up to their daughter's prom with a shotgun.
It's the same, like, the people that, like, behind closed doors and not in public would say, like, I'm not letting my child marry outside the race.
Yeah.
Out-of-state special interests that put trans ideology in classrooms and encourage sex changes for kids are hiding behind slick ads. Don't be fooled. You can keep this madness out of Ohio classrooms and protect your rights as a parent by voting yes on August 8th. Keep your promise to her. Vote yes on August 8th.
To her.
Keep your promise to your daughter.
And the trans ideology. I mean, I was unaware, apparently, that there are also trans men, right? Or trans boys. It's just so funny how, like, the anti-trans panic is so focused on trans girls in particular.
Well, it's like literally they think if you
or
go...
maybe I have that reversed.
If you go to a library and a drag queen reads The Very Hungry Caterpillar to your child, that they're going to be completely confused about their gender identity.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, the point is, again, this is... I mean, it's almost impossible to prove that it actually is helpful to Democrats. But it clearly is not helpful to Republicans. And were it not for the fact that it actually, like, endangers people, threatens lives, takes lives, destroys lives, all of this anti-trans rhetoric by Republicans, you know, I would be funding organizations to promote it, because normal people look at this stuff from Republicans and go, they're bat crap crazy.
Yeah.
Like, why do they care?
Yeah.
You know, they tried to do this and they did it to some effect in 2004, but it lost its salience as, frankly, as, you know, younger people grew up and started to vote. And older people died. They tried to make people scared of marriage equality by saying it's going to destroy your marriage. That, I mean, they're it's such a reach here. Like, okay, is it really going to destroy the institution of my marriage? I mean, like, if it destroys the institution of marriage, maybe it does destroy marriage, and maybe, like, that was a stretch. Yeah. It was a stretch. But like the just the general homophobia worked because, you know, that guy I work with, that woman I work with, I think they're gay and they're around me and it freaks me out, whatever. But they're now having to sell exactly what Matt's saying. It's somebody's reading a book in a library, probably going to turn your kid into trans. Mm-hmm. You know, like that's how it works.
And then when cats and dogs didn't rain from the sky after marriage equality happened, the fear mongering is completely sapped.
It was completely sapped and just generationally. But there's not even a toehold here, except for in the most sort of like bigoted transphobic sections. Which is, you know, to be fair,
a lot of
could be 50% of the 60% of the Republican Party, but that's not going to carry an election.
Yeah.
And were it so the fact that you could read a book in a library and convert your kids, my kid right now would be was read Balto so many times that he would be like pulling a sled through those floodwaters in Juneau.
Yeah.
It just doesn't work that way.
Their symbolism is just so insular, like the semiotics. There, look at this picture of a scissor, and it's like in the context of a classroom, most people are thinking like, oh, what are you cutting out? Like, you know, some type of like.
Like an angel or something like that. Yeah.
Whatever.
But for them, it's like that symbolized to them like genital mutilation.
Oh, of course.
They're psychos. I was scanning this earlier, but the Ettinger Mentum newsletter did a really deep dive into the history of transphobia as it relates to electoralism. But I'll just like list off the losses from 2022. Tudor Dixon was transphobic. Whitmer won in 2022. Evers, his opponent, Tim Mickles, was ran on like wokeness and in part and trans stuff. Lost to Evers. Mastriano lost to Shapiro. Dr. Oz lost to Fetterman. Cortez Masto won. Katie Hobbs defeated Carrie Lake. I mean, Mark Kelly defeated Blake Masters. On and on and on. There is just not the evidence there to support the fact that trans issues are in any way translating to electoralism for a negative for the Democratic side. So when people say that, just know that it's like them thinking that it's a little weird and then projecting that onto electoral outcomes, which has like really no bearing on larger statistical trends that involve like millions and millions of people voting. It's just not translating.
It's one thing to speculate how stuff is going to land in voters' ears. It's another to speculate and completely ignore every single data point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, and it is not as if like you've got Democratic lawmakers going out there and passing laws for people to be mandatorily, you know, mandatory trans.
Everyone has to be they, them until sixth grade.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, like, again, like, there's, you've got the AMA or the American Pediatric Society is both affirming the trans care as they have established the guidelines now for pediatrics, and saying we're in constant review.
Yeah,
which is exactly what you would want,
right?
And the idea that government is going to intervene in that situation, I mean, I am open to the idea of having a single payer system and a government intervening in the context of being in a position to evaluate, like, what's the efficacy of getting a colonoscopy at age 30 as opposed to getting it at age 40, and what instances do you you encourage a colonoscopy at those different ages, or you know, a mammogram, or you know, this type of treatment for that type of ailment, or this type of gender affirming care at this age versus that age in terms of outcomes. I mean, I am for more state intervention within the context of medicine, without a doubt, because it would be a more effective way to A, establish efficacy, B, make sure it's being done in the patient's best interest as opposed to the profit incentive. But that's not what's being advocated here. It is a random, we're going to impose our social morality, our religiosity on other people's medical care via, I guess, presumably the government as a one shot. Like, we will use government to enforce our religious edicts, but not to provide any other services to the citizenry. That's basically what we're hearing. Let's go to the phones. Calling from a 617 area code. The number is 646-257-3920.
Hi, Sam. This is Desmond calling from Boston.
Desmond from Boston. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm glad this segued into the issue of gender-affirming care, because this was brought to my attention. People were asking me questions, and cisgender, heterosexual, now 60 years old, but a longtime ally of the queer community. And people were asking this because of a particular side effect mentioned of bone density. They were asking me because I've had to personally deal with bone density issues, and I am much more informed because of that. I have dairy protein intolerance. I've had to be dairy-free for 45 years and had to, for the past 10 years, undergo bone density tests. I'm proud to say the last test a few weeks ago, my doctors were actually impressed with. But this caused me to research and to respond that the amount of distortion and just deceit that goes on from the right on this. So people hear that puberty blockers cause problems with bone density. The nuance on that is completely missed. What happens is that when a child enters puberty, there's sort of a rush in the body system to produce what's called peak bone density.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't do that because of problems with hormonal levels or nutrition or exercise, you don't quite reach that, and that can increase risk later on for osteoporosis or its precursor, osteopenia. That's why I had to be very careful when I was diagnosed at 15 with casein intolerance. You hear the right arguing that teenagers are getting osteoporosis because of puberty blockers, which is just plain bullshit. And this is the kind of tactics that they use, and this is what we have to be aware of and be armed with the knowledge to respond to them.
I mean, you're completely accurate, because I actually went through this myself, given like bone density issues in my family. And mm-hmm. that's the conversation that if you have that history, your pediatrician has with you to take calcium and that kind of stuff when you're going through that period of puberty where you're most susceptible to falling behind in that area. So that's when you're supposed
exactly.
to, but like, that's just about the changes in puberty as opposed to the blockers themselves.
Right. Because the only cases I've known, because I did research when I was hearing UK anti-trans people arguing that there were kids with osteoporosis, I only found two case studies of people in their teens who had severe osteopenia. And in both cases, all three factors that I mentioned, hormones, nutrition, exercise, were severely compromised.
Yeah.
And so that's rare. But as I tell my friends whenever this topic comes up, if I can manage without dairy to maintain good bone health for 45 years, a kid on puberty blockers for 2 or 3 years with constant medical supervision should not have that problem. And if they do, that's why they have a supervision, so that they can intervene when necessary, do whatever extra steps are needed.
Yeah.
But the right doesn't want people hearing that.
And they never cared about it when puberty blockers were being used for children that were mm-hmm. Entering puberty too quickly and it was not mm-hmm. Comporting with their growth. As if those considerations hadn't been taken when that puberty blocker usage was prescribed by doctors, like as if that hadn't been considered. It's just It's ridiculous.
It's concern trolling, which to define it is the action or practice of disingenuously expressing concern about an issue in order to undermine or derail genuine discussion.
It's the same reason they hate surgery all of a sudden, just because like there's blood involved.
Appreciate the call, Desmond. We should just say, you know, WTF, Cody just IM'd. Bone density is probably also pretty affected by poverty, malnutrition, bullets blasting through bones. And the point being that if you are a bone density advocate, and that is what you are genuinely concerned with, there are about four or five probably serious issues that you're going to want to resolve before you come even anywhere close to the idea of puberty blockers.
Including the access to medical care you mentioned at the beginning.
Access to medical care, you know, good nutrition, making sure that people have the ability, like green spaces in cities, so they can go out and exercise. You know, broadly poverty, like stress issues and cortisol levels, without a doubt. Appreciate the call.
Thank you.
Full-time bone density advocate, part-time women's sports protector.
Exactly. I split my time between bone density advocacy and
looking at the bylaws for the girls softball team.
Women's
down the corner.
Women's and girls sports organizing charters reform.
I mean, hey, it's nice to have niche hobbies.
That's what I do. That's where I spend my time. That's actual justice warrior. Georgia from Belgium. Been a majority reporter for nearly 10 years and have never requested a shofar. May I please have one for my 40th birthday? And an extra whoopsie, please, just for laughs. A big happy birthday from me to your daughter, too. I remember listening to Air America when you announced her birth. I feel old. Oh, you feel old. You feel old. I saw a guy do comedy last night, and he was, he was making a joke about Tom Brokaw and about how, he had to explain who Tom Brokaw was.
Oh, really?
To the audience. You know, Tom Brokaw was a guy who would read the news at night on the TV, and, he coined that the greatest generation, and he was a big news reader on the TV every night at 6. And after the show, I talked to him and I said, I'm old enough to remember when Tom Brokaw was on the Today Show, not doing the news. And he's like, I didn't know that.
He was on the Today Show? I did not know that either. There
Jane Pauley. Yep. Before Brian Gumbel.
Well, it's like for me with athletes now, they like don't, some of these athletes, like they ask about like their favorite hip hop music and like they don't know who like Tupac is. Some of them are like, oh, I don't really listen to Biggie or it's like the 90s. It just doesn't exist.
I mean,
guys born in 2004.
You know, you mentioned the change in the media and like MASH, but like I was reading something and it was like LBJ reacting to Cronkite coming out against the Vietnam War. And he's like, well, we're screwed then. And I'm trying to think of like what remotely like. What takes the place of Cronkite remotely?
I mean,
Mr. President,
I'm not
those networks.
You look at like things like Shirley Sherrod back in the during the Obama years and Acorn and stuff like that. I mean, when Fox News goes all in, it's not the same as just one guy saying one opinion, but it functions in the same way, without a doubt. You just don't have it. And here's the thing that the right does. Far better than, the nominal left. They don't have disparate voices. Or let me put it this way. They have disparate voices, but they're all saying the same thing.
Yeah. Just with different,
it's just unbelievable the way that it just, and I think it's, I don't think there's a conspiracy here as much as it is just sort of like laziness.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
that's why every single right-wing show had a Barbie movie take.
It's just that they know that's
it's not coordinated. That's just like they know that's the button to push, and here we go.
There may be some consultation in some areas, but yeah, it's just like, oh yeah, they're talking. Like I watched that show, so
Yeah, it is interesting. Like, there was a story. I can't remember if it was Media Matters or someone, but it was like how all of a sudden the right wing media, like Crowder and Shapiro, were taking their fire away from Facebook and Twitter and pointing it all at TikTok. And it might have been some kind of lobbying effort maybe behind that. But yeah, I think generally it's often just like, oh, we can get attention.
Sense. Yeah,
that makes sense. Oh, this is a good story. I don't know if we brought this up at the time back in June, but here's a video from June in Houston, Texas. Food Not Bombs is an organization in Houston that has been feeding the homeless, I think, for like 10 years.
Wow.
On the unhoused folks. And Houston started to crack down on them because, of course, why wouldn't you? Check this out.
So I'll see you tomorrow. How about you too, huh? See you guys in the morning. All right, thank you.
Okay. Can you explain to us what just happened?
I just got my 11th ticket for feeding the homeless, and this is number 30 for Food Not Bombs.
Cool. We're in front of the public library, which says that we don't have the right to, you know, be here. And, yeah, we're conducting a food service event without the consent of the property owner. And it says, in parentheses, feed homeless. A specialty law that is being forced specifically just on us. It's wonderful. So we will continue to protest until there is change.
So that was a TikTok that was put up by Food Not Bombs back in June. And there has been, you know, each of these folks who've been working for them have been cited. The whole organization, like I said, been cited at that time, like 30 times. Mm. Washington Post reports, and I had seen this in, I think, one of the Texas papers, but I didn't have access to it, to be honest with you, a couple of days ago. Philip Cohn has been working with Food Not Bombs, feeding unhoused people for once a week, at least, for the past 12 years. Picone was aware that city officials are trying to pressure people like Picone to stop feeding unhoused people. I can't even, like, I don't know if it's because they don't like where it's being done, or it's just like they're just twisted, or they think that, like, well, if there's no food, I mean, like, they treat them like they're literally like
animals. It's NIMBYs. Like, I'm fine if they eat, but not here. It's like they've dehumanized unhoused people to this point that they're treating them like pigeons, and it's like, right, someone throwing shit.
They'll be around if you start feeding them. It's literally like why they say don't feed the pigeons.
Yeah.
So Picone steeled himself. He cooked the pasta the following afternoon, drove downtown to serve it in front of the library around dinner time. After he was finished dishing out food, an officer cited him for violating a city ordinance that, in effect, prohibits people from serving more than a handful of unhoused people. On July 28th, nearly 5 months after Picone got the ticket, a jury acquitted him. His is one of dozens of cases that the city of Houston is prosecuting against volunteers accused of violating a 2012 ordinance that bans people from providing charitable food services to more than five individuals without a property owner's approval. For Food Not Bombs, which has served the homeless people at the library for at least 15 years, that means getting approval from the very entity that's trying to force them to move, the city.
Well, that's a consequence of not having enough public spaces, but two, also, just a note, like, you just, when cops are doing this, there's a reason that people say that their cops are there to protect property, not people. Yeah. That this is an example.
City officials said they'd keep vigorously prosecuting the cases. At least 47 have been filed since March 1st. There's been an increase in complaints, according to them, in incidents regarding unhoused people congregating near the library.
But those incidents will go down if those people are hungrier.
Well, also, like, if it was that narrow of a concern, why isn't the city working at least with people who are doing, like, A, why isn't the city taking care of this problem? And B, why isn't the city working with these people who are volunteering to help and come up with some solution that you know, that works.
I mean, there has been some progress in Houston. I know it's been a little bit bumpier recently, but I've referenced this a lot. Their Coalition for the Homeless reduced unhoused people in the city by like a drastic amount. But that was an Obama HUD like pilot program, and that's how that was funded. This, like, city governments, they often are answering to constituencies that don't want them to do anything to make lives of the unhoused easier.
They want them to harass them out of the city into somebody else's problem.
Yeah.
Well, good for these folks. And if you're in Houston, there is a petition they have collected 33,000 signatures from people urging the city to rescind the ordinance. Apparently in 2012, the city council passed the ordinance, and the then mayor wrote in a news release she had carved out an exception for Food Not Bombs by approving Central Library Plaza as a charitable food service location. So for 11 years, they were fine. And then I guess the new mayor decided,
Such thing as a free lunch.
Yeah, I like the idea that, like, Jesus literally could be reincarnated or come back the second time or whatever tomorrow, and he'd show up in Houston trying to feed the homeless, and he'd get ticketed.
Well, I mean, how would you make him pay?
He didn't have a permit, yeah.
Yeah, he could probably just, if you could do water into wine, he just makes the money.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, don't convert water into wine for more than five people.
Exactly.
Crowder, maybe.
Crowder? You really want to get to that? Let's get to, all right, let's get to Crowder. And then I want to do that Rogan with your good buddy, Matt.
Rogan with my good buddy or Dore with my good buddy?
No, Rogan was in it with PDB, right?
Or do oh, else? Yeah. Okay,
I don't
yeah.
know if we have that Dore with Eric Weinstein, do we?
Yeah, we do.
Oh, all right. Well, let's do this Crowder thing. Hey, folks, there were big news yesterday. Oh, wait, didn't we already talk about this?
No.
This latest one?
Not this latest one.
Which one are we talking about? We didn't do this about...
Not about the NDA. We made the slap-ass joke, but we didn't go through the piece.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
I just find a few anecdotes from this to be a little bit funny.
Well, we're doing this because Emma wants to do it. I mean...
Look, I'm going to be honest with you. I wanted to say the word sack tap on air.
Yeah, sorry. Sack tap, not slap ass.
No, not slap ass. I mean, there's a good amount of grab ass, sack tap.
Doing Key and Peele references here.
Yeah.
So the Steven Crowder implosion continues. And let's just, before we get to this story about the NDAs... we mentioned the other day, we put up a graph, right? Well, so we put up this graph about his like viewership dropping precipitously, like almost like it's like so much that I suspect that maybe, Rumble's not giving him the true viewership, or maybe they weren't in the beginning. I don't
know.
Maybe
there's something a little bit inflated early on.
Yeah, or maybe they're mad at him, and that's why they're making it seem like it's so low. It's just so hard to believe that the guy joins Rumble. Of course, it's going to take a little bit of time to build an audience. It takes him like about a, you know, it would appears to be basically a month and a half from midway through January to the beginning of.
See, I think that the channel wasn't fully launched yet there. I think like they maybe like in that sort of February period where there's that first incline up, I think that's probably when they just started.
Right. No, yeah, that makes sense. But then within like a month, they rocket to 2.5 million views, and then it just drops like a stone, except for when it came out about his ex-wife.
The ring footage.
And I think they're really sensitive to this because they put up this graph. Rumble came out and did this, which is really odd.
Which you can't really trust, because if these platforms have financial relationships with their creators, like it's pretty clear they do for a variety of them, they're going to be incentivized to juice these numbers from a PR perspective.
And let's be clear. This says Steven Crowder reaches $7.5 million in subs for 23. Now, he turned down, like, what was it, $25 million a year?
$50 million over 4 years.
$50 million over 4 years?
Yeah.
Was that it, really?
I'm pretty sure that's what it is.
I thought it was maybe a little bit more than that, but let's say it's $50 million for 4 years. And so he's had to add a couple of people, you know, big names, like Alex Jones and, Hodge Ryan Callen, the Hodge twins. I don't know who that is.
Nick DiPaolo.
And Nick DiPaolo.
Wow. He's
had to bring a lot of people on.
Couldn't quite get Jim Brewer.
And here's the thing, is that, like, do we have any more description of what this says?
Well, so look at on the Rumble description itself. Top streamer Steven Crowder surpasses $7.5 million in subscription payments within 5 months. So a little bit more specific than the Chiron.
Yeah, but it does it, though. It seems a little bit. Let's read this thing. This is the story that was released, and it's
on Rumble.com. It's a press release.
It is a classic. Let's keep it right there for a second. Everybody knows that you release your subscription numbers 5 months in. It's not like it's a panic situation that they're trying to change some type of narrative.
It's just a coincidence that Media Matters put out that.
Just a total coincidence. He has surpassed $7.5 million in subscription payments to his Mug Club community since launching his show on Rumble in March 2023 with a promotion for the 3 month free subscription. Now, here's what doesn't make sense to me. March, right? People join in March, April, May, June. Assuming they all joined in March, they got 3 months free. They haven't got $7.5 million in the bank.
Well, I don't know.
What they're saying is that annualized, this is $7.5 million. Maybe.
Well, I don't know. Like, it says Rumble recognizes subscription revenue proportionally over their respective subscription term because most Mug Club subscriptions are annual. The full $7.5 million will not be recognized as revenue in Rumble's financial statements at the time the funds are collected.
Oh, so we should just trust them on their word?
So the point is that people get 3 months free. Then, theoretically, the year-long subscription kicks in. He's only been on since March 2023. And we know it took a little bit to launch. So we don't know how many of those people cancel.
Mm-hmm.
And they're still waiting on the full 7.5 to be recognized.
There's no way the 7.5, that's what I was telling you before. It didn't sound right.
Well, because let's say the $7.5 million was cash they've got in already in this small period. And it's not. But even if it was that, that's about where he would need to be to make it worthwhile for, like, Daily Wire to have given him $50 million, and he would need to keep
He would have needed $50 million. Let's be
it's
clear.
$50 over 4
is $12 million a year.
Right, and he's at about
$5 million short right now, and
in 5 months.
But here's the thing: he has to continue to grow.
Yes,
what he has just done is he has gotten all of his existing audience to port over. Mm-hmm. If they haven't ported over now, they're not going to port over. There's no Mug Club members who are going like, I'm going to wait 5 months to join up again. Right. No, they all did it in the first 3 or 4 months. They didn't even have to pay. So there was no bar to getting there. There's a reason why he comes out on August 8th. And says, we've got Alex Jones now, and we've got Nick DiPaolo. It's because we need to convince those people who are on freebie to stay on and not cancel once that first payment comes in, because they know.
Right.
And so the only thing that's going to happen to that $7.5 million, mark my words, is that number is going to go down.
Yep.
And then they're hoping over time they're going to attract more members on Rumble, but again, put up that graph. If I'm looking at this and I'm going, wait a second, how are we going to attract more members?
How are you going to grow?
Our number's a fraction of what it was when we started.
Exactly. Exactly.
And I got news for you. Like, I don't know if this number represents the people who subscribed, but they better hope it didn't.
Right.
They better hope this is the non-subscribers, because if this is the subscribers number, it looks like they're not liking what the product is now.
Right.
Well,
and they're certainly not attracting new audience.
It's not a coincidence that they put out that statement, just to bring it full circle, after this article came out and this was being widely circulated.
Maybe
we
will hear from some insiders.
Maybe.
At Crowder's show. Oh, well, look at this.
We did.
Four Steven Crowder staffers exit show after interrogations and insane NDAs.
Well, now let's...
Wait a second. Didn't he have a problem with an NDA being signed with Daily Wire? Or am I imagining that?
Not the NDA. Not the NDA part, I think. It was the...
I think what the mentioning was that Candace Owens wanted to speak to people from the show who were struggling to wriggle out of their NDAs.
But so, NDAs are very...
Like not Gay Jared and Sven Computer.
NDAs are very commonplace, so much so that it's I mean, even like left-of-center organizations... Oh, right. Outside of ours. Like, it's anti-free speech, I just gotta say. Yeah.
Of course it is.
I mean,
I don't know. I think sometimes you got perfectly good reasons to want to shut people up when they leave your
purpose.
Emma's gonna pass out.
It's just, I need that pizza.
So apparently Crowder was really pissed.
Yeah.
About the whole story about them playing, what is it? Sack tap.
We call it nut tap in my middle school.
Sack tap.
So apparently they made all of their staff sign NDAs that say, if you speak about the show, you will have to pay them $100,000.
And this happened after Mediaite put out their report about the drug use, the bullying, the sending of genitals to male staffers, of photos of genitals to male staffers, Crowder doing so, allegedly, the alleged placing of his genitals on other male staffers' body, like, as a joke, man, but...
I will let you deliver the statement that I know you want to deliver, but here, let me set it up for you. So apparently, you know, Crowder was livid in the wake of that report. And the NDA that people had to be signed, I hereby acknowledge that said damages are reasonable. That's $100,000 liable to the company for liquidated damages in the amount of $100,000. Said damages are reasonable, do not constitute a penalty. And I further agree I will not contest the reasonableness of said liquidated damages in any action commenced by either party with respect to this amendment. So they add an amendment onto the contracts. Now, I don't know contract law that well. I don't know. There are certain provisions that are simply, by law, unenforceable because they are too onerous. This sounds to me like one of those, but I don't know. They were told they had to sign the NDA by that Friday. On July 27th, Crowder held a meeting in which he warned staff against speaking out. He was livid. He and Gerald, that's the CEO and his sidekick, said they knew someone was talking to the author of this piece at Mediaite. Based upon the article you wrote, they said whoever text messaged former employees about us not being able to hang out with them would be giving amnesty if we confessed by 2 p.m. You believe this? This is like some type of like World War II, like a prison camp movie.
It is. I mean, it's an odd workplace in many different senses.
If no one confessed,
the CIA,
if no one confessed, they would see it as malice. No one confessed, so they started interrogating a few people.
I mean, this really sounds like the Game of Thrones, like the confess thing, like, right? The religious fundamentalists.
Yeah, exactly. This is go to like the Septa, Mordain, and shame. During the meeting, Crowder downplayed his sexual misconduct allegations. And just to be clear, these are separate from the sort of emotional abuse allegations from his ex-wife. That were in many ways substantiated by the release of a video. I just want to make that clear. Mm-hmm. I want to be absolutely clear. And he's this is another source close to the soon to be divorced father too. So they have multiple sources.
Yes.
In the building. This has got to drive him nuts.
Very well sourced, as was her original article, which had multiple sources who verified the genitalia stuff, the harassment, all that. And here we go.
And Emma, I will allow you to provide what Crowder told the staff.
Yeah.
No pun intended.
So this is just the best part. If you're not okay with guys playing sack tap, then this isn't the place for you, the source said Crowder told staff, referring to the act of tapping another person's genitals. After the interrogation of current staffers, four employees departed the company. The NDA was insane, said the source close to Crowder. Most employees were scared because of it. Some talked to lawyers about it because they were afraid, but thought that if they didn't sign, that would incriminate themselves. He was intimidating. Stevens' increasing justification of his workplace sexual behavior between men makes a lot of male employees uncomfortable. He always says it's joking, but it doesn't seem like a joke to anyone anymore. Now, like, these are obviously Crowder staffers, so they have the homophobia embedded there. Like, they're more upset about it being towards men, it seems like, embedded in the quote. But either way, I mean,
it's one thing to put your genitals on a woman's
it's another thing to do it to men, because that's gay. But I just love the idea, like, Crowder barking at his employees, like, you didn't meet your sack tap quota today, man. Before you leave the office, I need to touch your balls at least five more times before the workday is through.
It's
ridiculous.
I cannot tell you how much I lament the fact that in interviewing people who worked here over the years, I never said, and what's your feelings about sack tapping?
Yeah.
I mean, just as, fun.
For fun.
Or just flashing generally.
I'm just in awe of the amount of times that Crowder has to work genitals into the workplace. It's just crazy. He's so repressed. This guy has so many issues that he has to find a variety of different ways, all under the guise of jokes, to work other people's genitalia, his employees, into the workplace. It's bizarre.
Bizarre. But you know, he's 36, and if you can't do sack tap at the office at age 36, when can you do it?
Yeah, right.
Besides junior high, when you're in junior high and you're on the playground.
If you can't tap your employees' sacks, like, what's the point of the American Revolution?
It's called freedom and liberty.
Yeah.
Oh, isn't that the classic, though, libertarian sort of principle? My rights end right
where your balls begin.
Just slightly past where your balls begin. Isn't that what it is? Straight?
I think I heard that before.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the
my rights. Say it again.
my right to punch you ends right just past where your balls begin. Calling from a 347 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from? Do we 347? Are you there? Hey, why isn't this working for me? All right, it's like I'm hitting the green button and they're not popping up. 347. All right, let me try it with this. 424.
Hello.
Hello. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Oh, wow. I got through. Hi.
Hi.
I am Cyrus.
Cyrus?
Where are you? I live in California, but I am from Trinidad.
Okay. Cyrus from Trinidad, living in California. What's on your mind?
First, I want to shout out my brethren, Dave. Just want to say, keep flying that Caribbean flag. Hi, brother. You just make me proud every time you talk, for real.
All right. There we go. All right.
Shout out, Dave.
Shout out to Dave.
This call is, as a leftist, I have realized, like, some of my friends, especially like when we do like on-house outreach and stuff, there's always this like underlying feeling that we're not doing enough. And I think sometimes we need to hear that our enough is a lot, you know, because like I think leftism is steeped in compassion, and the other side of that is kind of exploitative. So we find ourselves in this war of attrition, so to speak, where it's just wear you down. And I just wanted to say that. And then it have, like I kind of want to plug something into, which is a spinoff of that thinking. Because like me personally, I don't like picketing or marching, but it's not because like I'm a lazy leftist or whatever. Is it changes my relationship with large crowds. Because like I'm from Trinidad and we tout ourselves as the epicenter of the modern day carnival. So when I find myself in pickets or like large groups for change, it feels, it shifts from a jubilant environment to a adversarial environment, you know? Not like we're there to fight or anything, but still, you have like police and that could go bad at any moment. So I personally started to like be a little bit introspective. Like I work in film, so I was like, how do I contribute using my skills and like being comfortable and, you know, happy?
Right.
So like me and some friends came together and we have like this animated miniseries that we recently put up on YouTube, which is like also in keeping with Caribbean culture. We are really good at satire and parody. And there's not a joke. There's not leading to a joke or anything. There's like we really just, when you focus in on Caribbean culture, that's what it is. So we came up with this idea called Freedom Warriors, Freedom, F-R-E-E-D-U-M-B, Warriors, where it's set in this animated world, and I'm just giving a heads up. It's not like we don't have, like, money, like PragerU, to make, like, these really pretty videos.
All
There's
right.
Three people
well,
trying
you don't have to
get this idea out.
What is the, so, what's the name of the channel?
Freedom Warriors, F-R-E-E-D-U-M-B.
I'll tell you what, we'll put a link to it in the in our description today.
Oh, sweet. Yeah, because it basically is a satire on set in a world where Donald Trump has superhero serum and he's trying to put together a team of super conservatives, but it magnifies the worst of them in a comedic way.
All right. We'll check it out. Appreciate the call.
Thank you.
Oh, good. Thank you. Keep up the good work, guys.
Thanks.
Cheers.
Let's go to 773 area code. Who is this? Where are you calling from?
This is Hugh from Chicago.
Hugh from Chicago.
This is really crazy.
Hold on one second, Hugh. Wait. Nabaki Tendo, you are going to... Why do they keep spamming? Is that even like a... Is it a bot? It's so weird. They're not. It's like they're not even listening to the show. Stop texting us. I'm sorry. 773. Who's this?
Don't,
where are you calling from? Where are you calling from? I don't mean to take this out on you.
Oh, no, it's fine. I'm like I said, I'm Hugh. I'm from Chicago.
Hugh from Chicago.
I just wanted to, yes. I wanted to say, just like relay a couple of things that I read in the Tribune last week that I thought people would find interesting. One of them is they did a whole article on restorative or justice.
Yeah.
They have three different like courts, I guess they're calling them, but they've seem to function a little bit more like kind of like group therapy, kind of. That's the way it seemed in the article. One of them's in my neighborhood, and I was just kind of proud of that. The like recidivism rate is like 14% compared to like, you know, 60 something.
Yeah, that's low.
Yeah. And the other one was there was a conservative activist group called like Illinois Conservative Union, and they got assistance from Judicial Watch, and they sued to have access to like all of the voting records of like everyone registered to vote in Illinois, and they succeeded. Mm-hmm. So they have my like email address, phone number, etc. And that just seems a little bit worrying.
Well, wait a second. What are the two? How are the two things related?
Oh, they were just two things that I wanted to bring up.
Oh, okay. All right. I'm sorry. Well, you know, I mean, here's the thing. The voter registration rolls are, you know, more or less public.
Yeah.
So there's only so much you can do about that. And, you know, they're not, there's ways in which you can sort of make it backfire for them if you want to. When you get one of these push poll polls or survey calls, keep them on the line for a long time. Say the most bat crap crazy things you can say. Encourage them to spend money on you.
Mm-hmm.
That's the best way to deal with this. They're not, you know, specifically targeting you per se, but you can make their lives a little bit more miserable. But I appreciate the call. And if you've got an article on that, restorative justice, send it to majorityreporters at gmail.com. Yeah, always interested in hearing about it.
Yeah. Quick shout out to my brother, Ray. Thanks, guys.
All right.
Shout out accepted.
Two trench kids in a trench coat. Sam, you clearly haven't read any serious libertarian thinkers, because if you had, you would have heard of the nut aggression principle. Where true liberty can be achieved if your employer slaps your sack with the back of his hand.
There's no exploitative contracts, even the ones that include the nut tab.
That's so fantastic.
Yeah.
I'll just say, like, being offered $50 million over 4 years doesn't strike me as, like, anything remotely akin to slavery and the moderation. But forcing employees to shut up and sign NDAs is not slavery, but, like, at least on that continuum.
Yeah.
Also, I would say being subjected to you smacking them in the nuts on, when the thought occurs to you is, right. Like, a lot more, it seems to me, exploitive.
Yeah.
Than getting paid $50 million.
Unless you would have taken that money and just been fine with Ben Shapiro slapping you in the nuts. Maybe that's the case. I don't know.
I just, Matt, you were just saying, like, we were talking about this yesterday. Like,
got you.
When was the When was the last time that either of you guys experienced that in your life?
There was a big nutsack tapping phenomenon that was in my middle school, and then basically, my recollection is that died down once we all started talking to women.
Energy didn't have to go through.
Definitely happened to me in my high school locker room, and it was always by people who, like, frankly, I was like, I'm not comfortable with you.
I don't
doing
like
this.
You. Right?
We're also not close enough for me to think this was, like, funny.
I have an admission to make. I have been. Saul went through a stage. He's 10 now. He went through a stage at the beginning of last year where apparently they're doing that thing where they, like, I don't know, they hold, like, your hand down here. I don't know, because I don't think they invented it when I was
a kid. The thumbs up or something.
Something where girls then if you don't, you get the nuts, the sack thing. So
you'd put it near your, you know.
Yeah. My 10-year-old son has recently grown out of this stage.
Oh, gotcha.
So I've got to break the news to him that, like, dude, your dream of working on Crowder's show, that's out the window now. So sorry, bud. What should we do? Should we do Trump here?
Yeah, let's do that.
Donald Trump in New Hampshire. This guy's coasting right now. Like, he was asking, you know, should I do the, I mean, he's sweating quite a bit.
He addressed it. He was like, I'm so wet. I'm so wet.
They're going to say I'm wrong, but it's 104 degrees.
There's no air conditioning.
But he was like, you know, should I do the debate? Like, why would I? I'm a 50 points up. Why would I do it? Why would I do it? But
if he was 0 points up, he would still probably wouldn't do it.
Well, maybe
yeah,
he would,
know.
Actually.
I
yeah.
don't know.
He
would, I don't
yeah,
know.
Actually, it would be good.
I think he would do it, yeah.
Here is Donald Trump up in New Hampshire, in Windham, New Hampshire, yesterday.
Oh, it was that hot in New Hampshire? Damn.
Yep.
Well, climate change.
No climate change. I'm just a little concerned about my indictments.
And in the morning consult that just came out, I wanted to see, because, you know, every time you get indicted, I like to check the polls, because one more indictment that I think this election's over. One more.
I think he's going to get his wish.
No, it's horrible. You get indicted for nothing. Can you imagine a guy? Let's indict my opponent. This is a sick. This is a third. This becomes a third world country. The latest morning consult poll has us far ahead. We're at 59%, and the others are at like 12. One is at 12. I think that's the sanctimonious. But he's rapidly being caught by Ramaswamy. Who's good?
He's good. Sorry, I like that one, because that's the one guy that is not really going to be critical of him, right? He has nothing to lose. He's just in it to sell a book and a bunch of truth hats. And maybe he'll get transportation secretary at some point, and we'll get to hear some like train raps.
Yeah,
who's good?
I take the general like caution against indicting political people. You know, I think that's something to bear in mind. I think Trump being so conscious about it maybe seem like he's using it as a tool.
He's saying he's going to go after Biden if once he gets elected.
He ran in 2016 saying lock her up.
Yes.
Yeah.
And even at this rally, he said, I have to change. Like, it's she's no longer crooked Hillary, because that's Biden. It's beautiful Hillary. She's so beautiful, he kept saying.
He's going to lose votes if he keeps doing
that. Yeah, right?
Here is Trump addressing Chris Christie. Oh, yeah. Who apparently he's mad at now.
With
I mean,
policy.
Look, let me just say this. Chris Christie's horrible. And, you know, I don't know if I saw some rumors that maybe that the Democrats are like, you know, helping his campaign so that he'll be on the stage.
Would not be shocked.
And I am all in favor of promoting the most beatable candidate in a race. Sometimes you can't assess who the most beatable candidate is. But in other instances, it's quite obvious, right? Like, I mean, there was a couple of races in the 2022 cycle where it was quite obvious. Mastriano is worse than any other candidate in that Senate race against Mastriano against Shapiro.
Governor's race in Pennsylvania,
and that makes sense for the Democrats to write, you know,
and it worked.
Most concerned. Oh, and it worked in
everywhere
they tried.
Yeah.
It's failed in the past. You got to make a good choice and assessment, but the strategy itself makes sense. But the idea that funding the Christie campaign is going to in some way like hurt Donald Trump in the primary is just, I'm sorry. Nobody cares about Chris Christie. Nobody. Yeah. You've already won over Scarborough. You don't need to fund Chris Christie's stupid ass campaign.
And all those people are already voting Democrat anyway. Chris Christie is a blue state Republican, and so he appeals to like conservative Democrats or independents or whatever. And none of those people are voting in Iowa and New Hampshire in the Republican primary.
Who's good? No, Christie's he's eating right now. He can't
Thanks
be bothered.
Sorry.
Sir, please do not call him a fat pig. That's very disrespectful. Don't call him. See, I'm trying to be nice. Don't call him a fat pig. You can't do it. You can't do that. So now, because you're not allowed to do that, and therefore we're not going to do it, okay? We want to be very civil, right? So, the latest...
There he is. Some people would say that he's a fat pig, but I would never say that.
He's good at that.
I mean, it's his 2015.
He's playing all the hits again. And just lastly, let's just do the, you know, he's building in the critique here.
Of the venue.
Of the venue. Here, let's just play this.
And And by the way, I want to say officially for the press, it's about 110 degrees in this room. Nice job with the air conditioning, whoever. But you know what the press will say? You know what they'll say? Trump didn't look well. He was extremely wet. It's 104 or 5 degrees in this room. But we're okay with it, right?
Take it off.
I mean, the guy is campaigning well. He's going to just wipe the floor with all the other Republican nominees. The real question is that when it comes time to run in the general election, and let's just for the moment, you know, put aside the question of Biden's sort of like campaign competency or not. He's going to have a real problem because there is not going to be, he may add dollars and points within the Republican primary every time he gets indicted. But in the general election, it's going to hurt him.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is going to be, you know, how much is it going to hurt him?
But contrast that clip to what we played yesterday with DeSantis saying, you know, when I went to San Francisco, I saw someone defecating in the street. I mean, and into a room of just like, you know, half clapping people in Iowa. And Trump's like, you know,
thanks for coming from Florida to tell us that.
Right. It's just the energy is so different. And since you brought that op-ed up to me, I keep returning to it, honestly. Just like the fact that these Trump rallies, it's old school politics in certain ways where people go there and they feel like they're a part of, they're having fun. They're having fun and they feel like they're connecting with other MAGA people. It's insidious. But like there is that communal element. It's feeling like you're a part of something greater. That's what energizes a base.
Yeah.
Well, the other interesting thing too is that again though, it's like so devoid of like really any policy prescriptions or even positions on stuff. And increasingly, I think what's happening with the Republican Party is, you know, 15, 20 years ago, you hear people say, like, I'm socially liberal, but I'm, you know, fiscally conservative. But they have no fiscal conservative policies outside of tax cuts for really wealthy people. And Trump will ultimately move in that direction, you know, once we get into the general election. But largely, they've been running, and we see it in Ohio. You've got the Ohio Secretary of State running against Sherrod Brown in 2024, saying we need to pass this this obstacle to amending the Constitution because they're going to come in here and want to raise the minimum wage.
Mm-hmm.
This is a very odd pitch in Ohio, it seems to me. But we'll see. But certainly, you know, this we're going to get more of this from Trump, at least during the primary. And again, I will remind you, he needs to win this election to stay out of jail.
Yeah.
This is an existential election for him. So we've already seen it happening. On Friday, he's going to go in front of this judge who's going to talk about the protective order, basically saying that you cannot open source or you can open source your defense and put all of this evidence out there that the government is bringing to prosecute you with. Trump wants to release that evidence because it is part of his campaign. There is the defense strategy that he has, the legal defense strategy he has, and the campaign strategy he has are melded. They're the same thing. The only way he gets off on these things, I believe he believes, and I think with good reason, is by becoming president.
100%.
And so they're already beginning to demonize the judge the jurors in Washington, D.C. for essentially, they're not quite there yet. They're not explicit about it. They may never be explicit about it other than to sort of like, it's decrepit. They're horrible. They're uncivil. They're not bright. Whatever it is he's going to start to say, they are trying to basically say this is racially motivated. That's where they're going with this. Oh, 2:40 already. Holy cow. Sorry, guys. Did it again. All right. I'm sorry, folks. We don't have any more time for the calls. We'll read some IMs unless there's any. Ooh, never got to that Rogan PBD. You're going to have to do some of these tomorrow.
Yeah. Don't worry. I'll be able to get my blood pressure up for tomorrow, too.
Yep.
Folks, I will be out both tomorrow and Friday. I'll be back on Monday where we're going to celebrate Michael Brooks' 40th birthday by having a couple of guests on that were some of his sort of favorite guests that weren't necessarily regulars on the show. We'll do a couple of those, and then we'll have a couple of his, buddies on, and it'll be more of a celebration. It would have been 40 years old on Sunday, I guess it would be, is the 13th? Yes, Monday's the 14th. So he would have been 40 years old. Good time over this weekend to go back, watch some of the Michael Brooks show. We should set up a playlist. In fact, will you let Dorsen? We should set up a Thursday's playlist so that people can go easily watch some of the shows that he hosted over the years. Antifa Lockhart, if I spam you enough, will you answer my call? What if I spam enough? Will you answer my call? What if I spam you enough? Will you answer my call? Many of you have seen the photo of Ben Shapiro standing next to the Barbie movie display. So I have a community request. If anyone could measure the height of the Barbie movie display from the floor up, there's a little project I'm working on here. That is a congressional baseball fan. Let's get some IMs here. Vegan Marks, happy birthday, Mila. Sam from Momo, hello. How can a Republican from Ohio complain about tech billionaires when J.D. Vance is funded by Peter Thiel? Dragonfly, South Dakota Republicans tried the same thing last year. We rejected it 67%. Maybe Kowalski, you won't find the same person twice, not even in the same person. Powerful words for the constant evolution we take as individuals in our struggles through life, as well as my legal defense when I let the John Brown person in me take control. Left is dramatic pause best. For legal purposes, the majority report cannot be held liable, nor does not necessarily support the views of all of its IMers' actions, which are taken independent of the stated mission of the majority report. Yes, indeed. Thank you. Sleepy. My next guest is a bitch, a lover and a child and a mother. I don't know what that is.
Alanis.
I'm not sure why we're doing the Alanis Morissette reference. But
Pizza Talk. Do you remember when you asked Crowder how he knew he'd cut your stream short when he was ducking your debate and he responded because you're an idiot and half your staff doesn't like you? Apparently what he meant is you don't keep your staff in line through a steady regimen of molestation.
No, that was because I had a secret back channel to Crowder and I was sort of tipping him off on all the stuff.
Also, that was not Morissette. Sorry. Meredith Brooks. Got to correct myself.
Big Mike, y'all see the lawsuit against Lizzo and filed by members of her dance crew for sexual harassment that allegedly involved Lizzo forcing her dancers to eat bananas out of each other's vaginas? What?
Yeah, it's terrible. I mean, it looks horrible. It's funny, despite the right's obsession with her for being black and being bigger, I haven't heard much about this from them because they're okay with abusing your workforce.
Yeah, like they'll mention it saying like the left is hypocritical or so, as if she's like the left because
we didn't know about this and now we do and it's very bad, like horrible.
Yeah, there's a lot of entertainment bosses can be horrible.
Turns out.
Kirby 4242, we need to close the IMs and figure out what's going on. In all honesty, if Lizzo was in the studio, I would have no idea who she was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No idea. Doug Funny, how much money do you suppose is spent each year in the service of denying people access to healthcare? spent or made?
Or have invested.
All right, two more. Hack all things. Did someone say take it off during the end of that Trump clip?
That was me.
I think there's probably also people in the audience who said that as well.
I was joking.
Oh.
Well, he loosens his tie.
Yeah, well, hilarious. I mean, they would, they secretly, you know, want to see him naked.
And the final IM of the day. Custodial artist. Sam, you and the other IMers have it wrong. Steven obviously cares so much about men's health, he's doing a rapid cancer test. Who's to say Crowder didn't check more? New drop, new sound drop? He's good. Bradley, Matt, Emma, great job today. Folks, we'll see you tomorrow.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light's shining bright. Somewhere the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the man